justification from. So the people who engage seances, they worship ghosts, the people who worship disembodied entities, the people who can heal the sick, can know the future, and they're having a ghost, or they're having a disembodied entity that's sinister, that's using them, that will use them to even do some good things, but for ulterior motives. It's like the people who get some help from someone who has some sort of mystic power, and they immediately think, oh, this person is trustworthy, this person is very godly, and sometimes that is being used to control the individual or to harness the mind of someone. And so this can be very dangerous. And one of the reasons why people have to look closer at an individual's life. If someone is very powerful, exceptional powers, to know the future, read the mind, to heal the sick, whatever, we look at their life, their lifestyle. If somebody has this kind of power, and they're eating flesh, they're having illicit affairs, they are taking drugs, alcohol, we think God is so weak and so desperate that he can only use someone like this. He's so desperate, he's got to just find somebody to use, even though this person is so many bad habits that God is going to manifest very powerfully in this particular person. Or very pious demigods, or Gandharvas, or Jaharas, or Apsaras, are going to use this kind of person. No. This person is being used by some other sources. Now, where we find that someone is very selfless, someone is very compassionate, someone is living very austerely, someone is very mindful, prayerful, very pious, and they have power. We can understand. Oh, yes, so. This is connected with something of a more evolved and higher nature, and maybe more of an environment of safety, etc. Because we should always take notice of one's own character. We should always take notice, not just what the person says, but what do they really do? It gives us more consideration of what this individual is really about. Because we realize that everything that's happened externally coming from an internal construct. So somebody who's really divine is not constantly doing things of manipulation, of control, of exploitation, of coercion. That means this is what's in the mind. Some things in the mind is similar to what is coming forth. And someone who is doing so many wonderful things, genuinely, we understand. It's also connected with consciousness, etc. So there have always been powerful entities, influential entities. We see that just in our day-to-day societies. There are people who have power, and they use power to sit on others, or they use power to influence others, they use power to create power, politics, etc. And so they have money, they have influence, they have position, but they use it in a way that is not really for the benefit of the greatest number of people. And then we find also there are other people who have acquired certain abilities and powers, etc. But they are more concerned with how to empower others. They're more concerned with using it in terms of how to help. Because you want to help some people, then if you don't have some things to help them with, then it will just be sentimental. So there's a need for helping to be able to have ways to help people. Similarly, if you want to control people, there's a need to have ways to be able to control them, etc. So now when you look closer at just what is spiritual, it can be also evaluated based on just dealing with day-to-day relationships. Somebody's always asking you for something, and they're your friend. So you have a friend, and every time you interact with this friend, the friend is asking you for something. Oh, I'm so happy to see you today. Can I borrow your car? You know, I'm really in distress. I've made some bad investments, I'm in trouble. I have so many people I owe money to. Can you help me? Can you give me a big loan? You know, I haven't eaten all morning. What do you have to eat today? You know, the dress you had on last week was so beautiful. I think I'd like to have it so I can go out tonight, you know, to disco. Every time you see the person, there's a different thing or things they're asking you for. After a while, you start thinking, hey, what kind of relationship is this? What kind of friend really are you? Every time, it's a one-way track. You are considering and asking for something for yourself. You wouldn't feel comfortable after a while. As a matter of fact, at some point, you would probably begin to avoid this person. Say, so, well, what are you doing this afternoon? I'd like to come over. I don't think you... I'm busy. Huh? You see the person, you go the other way. So, just consider now, people who consider themselves to be religious, but their connection with the Godhead is always asking for something. Just as we were in a normal situation, would not consider this to be a very healthy relationship. We would actually feel intimidated, disturbed. We would feel used. We would feel neglected, denied. But many relationships are almost that bad, where people are even having relationships, so-called partners, but really it's utilitarian, it's opportunistic. So many arrangements are like that. Most of our jobs, most places, that if we somehow don't keep producing or doing something that the other one wants, we'll find everything will totally change. We'll be sacked, thrown out, you know, abused, denied, etc. That's a little mystical thing between the two of us. So what happens then, I'll take another case. There is someone who's in your life, and even without asking, they're always asking you how you're doing. They bring things for you. They go out of their way to try to do something that will, you know, be pleasing to you. There's someone who has just heard a little bit about some issues that's in your life, and they really take that and really try to see how to be there for you. You don't have to even get to the point that you're asking or telling them, but there's so much concern about you that they are constantly thinking about your well-being. That type of person who's in your life, you feel good about having their association. They validate you. They help you to feel a sense of worth, importance. You don't feel that they just want something from you, or they're being kind to you because they're really trying to use you in some way. And if you somehow are not in agreement, you'll find that they totally change. But this person, regardless, they're in the background, concerned about you. Well, this is obviously a more evolved, a more genuine type of relationship. As a matter of fact, we notice that the stronger and more genuine that the relationship is, the more the other person is even eager and happy to even inconvenience him or herself for your well-being. Just like, you know, some of you have children. And so, you are happy when you undergo some austerity or you inconvenience yourself in some way, but knowing that it's going to be for the benefit of your beloved child. Because you care for that child and you're concerned about their presence and their future. And so you don't find that your relationship with your son or daughter is just that you're trying to get something from her, something from him, and you call this, you know, parenting. No, it's natural that you're thinking about the well-being, and there are times when you have to inconvenience yourself, go out of your way to serve, to help, to facilitate. So this is the difference between materialism, or subtle materialism, difference between pseudo-religion, mysticism, and unconditional, unmotivated service and love. Difference between spirituality and just some sectarian religion or some involvement in metaphysical pursuits. In the sectarian religion, one is trying to have God only for themselves, only in the way they want, and they demand something from Him, and they don't give a hell about everybody else, and everybody else is going to go to hell, and everybody else is lost, and because God is only for them because of what they want to get from God. Or somebody's into mysticism, and they are trying to have the powers, and they want to influence and control, and they want to dominate, and they want to be the center of things. So really, what they're really saying is, God, why don't you move out the way, and, you know, let me try for a while. I think I can do a pretty good job. And so just like you would feel disturbed with somebody who's a so-called friend, and they just want something. Or they are a so-called friend, and they're really thinking how to study you so they can take over your job, take over your position, take over your wife, take over your husband. So people are, oh, let me study so I can become God. That means both of us can't be God, so let me push him out. I'll take the position. We can't both have the same one. Well, some days people do nowadays. They swap husbands, swap wives, all this stuff. So, but when we see that someone is caring so much about you that they are just thinking about your welfare, and they're happy even in doing something that arranges for your welfare, then this is some deeper level of interaction where there is some deeper affection and appreciation. So ultimately, religion means to know, to serve, and to love the Supreme Lord. Ultimately, religion means to follow the laws of God, or we say Krishna. So, therefore, when, and every religion talks about this, we talk about that in another man also, every major religion mentions, number one thing, love God with all your heart. We say Sharanagati, full surrender to the Lord. And two, every bona fide religion talks about being a servant of the servant. So daso smi daso daso no das. How to even love your neighbor even more. Not only as, but even more than yourself. And three, that we're not this physical being, this physical body. We're not residents of this physical world. That we have been sinning and we need to transform and repent. And so we say, hum the masmi, that we are really more than body. And hum amiti, we're not just the body and the physicality. So that's there in all bona fide religions. Now the question is, to what degree does one accept it? To what degree does one follow it? To what degree does one make such a priority? Because all the other stuff is detail. And so if the major focus is on Sharanagati, full surrender, then it means that we are allowing ourselves to be reclaimed back to our own divinity. Because we can't come in association with the Godhead if we're not godly. We can't really become residents of the spiritual world with His purity if we are not pure. And so this is there, but often it's minimized. Even though we know that ultimately the highest position is, dear Lord, thy will be done. Most people say, yeah, but I want this, I want this, I want that. But the higher position is to be at the mercy of the Lord, in that sense. So then, ultimately, spirituality is dealing with that level of commitment and dedication. But one is not just trying to be free of some disturbances in one's life. And so now, you've tried that through normal material means, it didn't work. So then you consider, well, let me try some other things. And so now you go into the subtle experiences of the astrologer, of the seer, or the sage, or you're trying to get the city power, mystic affections, or you want to read the mind, or astral travel, or you want to travel, or you want to be able to heal the sick, or all these kind of things. But yes, they're there, and they're technologies. But they're subtle material technologies, and not really spiritual. Why and how we analyze this is that just as we have our physical body We also have a subtle body, and we are the soul. So there are certain things that are associated with our physical body. But there are also certain realms of reality and experiences associated with our subtle body. And so much of what people normally call spiritual, that is part of the metaphysical and the psychic, are things associated actually with the subtle body. But the subtle body is also physical. It's just more subtle matter versus gross matter. So spiritual lifestyle and culture addresses the soul, gives nourishment, watering, stimulation, upliftment to the soul. So we can summarize it that, and then we'll take questions. That there are things that are done that give direct attention and care to our physicality. And that's the reality, the temporary reality. And then there are things that are connected with the subtle body. Subtle body is comprised of mind, intelligence, false ego, etc. So every time there's death, we give up the physical body. Death is, like I had this hat on, so I take the hat, put it on, I take it off, and now I go home, I put on another hat, or I change my dress, put on a suit, and so, or that's, his pants are dirty, we put on another pants, his dress, his sorry. So you put that aside. But you're still there, you put on something else. So every time there's death, we give up the physical body, and the subtle body then goes into another physical body, another situation for growth, evolution, maturation, and after a while, death again. So there are things that are directly connected with the physical body and its existence, and there are certain more metaphysical or psychic things that are connected with the subtle body, and therefore they manifest sometimes in the physical realm, arena. But because something is directing itself to the physical or the subtle physical, is not necessarily spiritual. Then the real question is, most people, they don't care. They don't care what something is spiritual. Their concern is, I need this and I want this, and whatever I need to do to get this, hey, I want to do it. And so if chanting this mantra, doing this Ouija board, doing this tantric, doing this, doing that, Hatha Yoga, Kriya Yoga, Stanga Yoga, connecting with Astara, Rosicrucian, Amok, Grail, Masonry, anything, as long as I get what I want. I haven't gotten it through just going to school. I haven't gotten it through just having a good job. I haven't gotten it from just being a proper good citizen. So let me try this God stuff or some metaphysical stuff. Let me try something so I can get what I want. Let me have this friend, that friend, so I can get what I want. Let me have this girlfriend, this boyfriend, so I can get what I want. Let me have these children, so they can give me what I want. It's like you're a gardener, and you're planting the seed, so you can later take the harvest. And so I have some children. So when I get older, they can all take care of me. And so one is constantly putting himself in the center. So when we see people do that, we realize it's not a deep relationship. Not really based on real compassion, real love. So since religion ultimately is about love that we experience as being fully divine and a love from God. And so there are things that interfere with that love. And so therefore, the Vedic Shastra explains that if one is too much interested in bhukti, so much material opulences and gratifications, and mukti, desire for liberation, or to have mystical, spiritual intoxication. Sometimes we have, material intoxication, more kind of drugs than alcohol. There's some people that become like mystic junkies. They want to do this kundalini, this, do that. They want to experience mystic intoxication. Ooh, that was a really good meditation. What do you think? So, they're still trying to feel good, either subtle or gross. And so the whole object is, let me try this, try that. How'd you feel? How was that? Amazing. So it's still this whole thing of, I want to enjoy, I want to experience, I want the intoxication. There's nothing wrong with wanting pleasure. We are pleasure seekers. That is natural to the soul. But there is, what is this? There's the prayas and the srayas. There are things that we get, and we get some very temporary gratification, and it doesn't last long, and it's not permanent. Then there are those which are long-lasting. And so what we're really looking at is that things that are just for material boons or for mystic boons, they have some value, but they are temporary because they're not addressing the real entity, the soul, that's eternal. And the things that we can do that's connected with the soul, then they're going beyond these other barriers. And so the goal of religion is to this last thing. You said love God with all your heart, to have this affection for the neighbors in terms of your actions, being a manifestation of a carrier of devotion, and that this world is not our home. So that means if these bodies and this world is not our home, then we have a home somewhere. We have a higher existence than these physical bodies. We are someone and something far greater than any of these bodies that we're using at this time. Each lifetime, we are using a different kind of body, and we park it, we get another body. And so that's like being a prisoner, that we're just constantly still being incarcerated in some kind of form, some type of environment. And so the goal of that prisoner is not to just to have a better prison suit, a better prison cell, a little more freedom, but to be ultimately totally freed. So the goal of spirituality is really to be freed from ever having to take another material body, from ever having to deal with disease, old age, and even death. Because even entities on the higher material planets, even someone who has mystic powers, is going to have to die. And therefore, all of that becomes just relative, because still, it's going to be lost. And so, in conclusion, that we're looking at today, that there are things that often people associate as being spiritual, and they're really arrangements to make material life better, or the arrangement to connect more with the subtler scheme of things. Is that powers not necessarily a sign of divinity? That one can also do austerities and rituals that can give shakti, give power, but can be misused or can be given by negative sources that will bring very much control and incarceration and degradation, on others. But at the same time, there are some people who are either born or have learned various techniques and how to use the subtle energies, or there are people who are spiritual, and their spirituality, then their existence has influence. But the greater type of mystic power is when mystical things happen around one. There are those who pursue and may or may not develop some mystical talent. But then there are those who have the spiritual endowment, and very often unusual things happen around them because they're protected or they're given insight and realization and understanding because they are more and more in the mood of being like puppets, for the Lord. Now, the more spiritual that someone is, the more having association with them gives other people benefit. Also, the more spiritual someone is, the more service you render, the more you hear, the more there will be some assistance and benefit. Also, the more spiritual someone is, when there is offense, the more serious that offense will have on the person who was the offender. So sometimes someone, for instance, is associating on the spiritual journey, and they make offenses, and they go backwards. Or sometimes someone is associating on the spiritual journey, and they have certain strengths, and all of a sudden, they lose their ability. They were brahmacharis. They lose ability. They fall down the sex life. They have great insight, and all of a sudden, their intelligence becomes completely into a mood of just anger and manipulation. Or they have power to withstand certain things, but then when they make the offense, their immune system gets weak. There are many, many stories throughout Vedic scripture and other scriptures where someone offends a saintly person who actually is spiritual, and then what happens is that person then loses some of their credits, and sometimes the person has the negative effect that can even go on for several lifetimes. One can be blessed for several lifetimes, the whole family, the whole village. One can be cursed, where it affects the individual, the family, sometimes the children, and generations. So what spiritual power is, it is very uplifting and very energizing, but it also can be electrocuting. And so we have to be very sensitive in trying to understand what really is spiritual and how to take advantage of it, in contrast to what is material opulences, or material intelligence, or material boons, what is mysticism, that's dealing with the subtle body. So that which nourishes the soul is always connected with the well-being of others. And it's always connected in relationship to trying to be the selfless servant of the Lord. And so when there's love, then there's more compassion and selflessness. And when it's not so intense, then there's utilitarianism or right-out manipulation. And so we don't want to be approaching the Godhead just for utilitarian purposes. We can't bribe the Lord and not give our hearts and think that it's going to reciprocate on the same level. But according to our level of surrender and desire, then we'll get certain boons and realizations. So let us maybe stop there, as we looked a little bit at the acidic powers, that there is this power making the body small, there's the power of making the body very heavy, there's the power like Hema City, being able to travel to other planets, there's the power of Isita, being able to create universes and planets. Sometimes entities even have this kind of power. They can even create a realm, a universe, you know, a kingdom. And then there's the power where one can do things in accord to material nature, and another can go outside of material nature. And then the power of material Sanjivani, bringing the soul back to life. Someone who has died, who is being, you know, brought back to life. So the pure devotees of the Lord, they may have sometimes all of these powers, but they are not any way interested in the parading of such. Because sometimes where one is displaying mystical or abnormal powers, it will draw people who will be interested, but mainly they'll just be envious, or mainly become fascinated with the power itself and not with the source and the essence of their power. And so more than not, even when someone is on a pure level, they refrain from the overt use of such powers. Where the person who's into the acidic powers per se are very eager to have, eager to show, eager to boast, eager to control. But we all know the greatest power is the power of love, because real love is in fact not something sentimental, but it has the biggest influence, and that is what genuinely connects us of selfless service and gives us the highest level, reclaiming our original identity. With the lust and the greed and all of those other things that's connected with materialism and subtle things, they're still a part of the lust and the greed of wanting to be the controller, wanting to have the experience for oneself. And as there becomes more selflessness, then there's a competition that goes on between the living entity and the Godhead, where the Lord wins. The more you serve, the more you give. So I do for day by day. The more you serve, the more you relish, the more taste, the more realization. The more one is really righteous and selfless, then there will always be more reciprocation. And where not, one can even lose in what they already have. So let's see, any questions or any comments?
Not everybody has a perfect job.
Does anybody have a perfect job?
I was thinking of somebody in the position of having a butcher.
Yes.
That's where he stands up. And he cannot move out of the understanding. What is the best way for somebody like that to do the best with what you've got, in order to be more spiritual in a very dirty material position?
Well, we should be a little more sensitive about the kind of work that we do. Because for many people, isn't it? Most people, they spend 8 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours every day their job. And so there's only 24 hours in a day. So they spend 8 hours at work, 6 or 8 hours at sleep, and they got about 8 hours or so left. And so a major part of their existence has to do with their work. Because even if they spend 6 or 8 hours at work, they're still preparing to go to work, thinking about work. Many people carry their work home. So, so much of their life is centered around their work. And so if one has a job that's sinful or degrading, then it means so much of their life is sinful and degrading. And so much of their existence is an unfortunate state. So, take a job, you know, where you are a butcher, or a job and you are, you know, overseeing a lottery, or you are, you know, running, you know, like a prostitution ring or something, or you're selling drugs. So these things make money. Sometimes some of the sinful things make more money than the ethical or the moral things. You can make a lot more money probably, you know, selling whiskey than you can, you know, selling bottles of water in some places. You can make maybe a lot more money in the profit, you know, of cigarettes than you can, you know, maybe from people selling tomatoes. So people may be more prone to pursue kind of sinful work. But there's karmic reaction that comes along with such. And they add to the degradation of society, you know, by doing that. So we should make work an expression of our life, of our devotion, of our service. But we have to look a little closer to see, is the nature of our work something that we can actually offer to God? Is it something that is helping to make the world really a better place? Or is it something that is really doing the opposite, speeding up, you know, the sinful culture? So one should look a little closer at the situation. Now a person may say, hold a minute now, any job has some sinful stuff involved. If it's business means cheating. If it's work, it means you got to pay taxes. And the taxes may go for this thing or that thing that may not necessarily be something that's godly. Yes, we can't control all of the variables, but there are things that are more distinct that we know about according to the jobs that we have. And so we should be more willing to try to not just to have a job, you know, but to have a life. Otherwise, so much of our life gets zapped away just by trying to make money and doing things that we hate, doing things that's disturbing to us and disturbing to the planet. Other questions? Well, most people on the planet are highly influenced, you know, by mind control without knowing it. Most people are not fully in control, you know, of their independent free will. Because everywhere you turn, there's some advertisement. You look at the bulletin board that's impacting upon the conscious and subconscious. There's music. There's sights. There's radio. There's television. You know, there's newspaper. So we're constantly being bombarded to accept, to think, to act this way. And advertisers, you know, really capitalizing on people's lust exists. So everything that's being sold is being sold, you know, in general, in such a way to make you think through your genitals. Make you think, if you have this condominium, you can also have this wonderful girl. If you buy this car, then you will get this. And so there's the car, and there's the scene that's connected with the car that's trying to implant into your consciousness, you get one, you get the other. And so from pencils and ballpoint pens to apartments and to houses, it's all trying to get people to think, yes, you can experience, you can enjoy. Huh? All you have to do is buy this. It's what you've been waiting for, what you've been wanting. You just buy this and you'll be attractive and you'll be wealthy and you'll have lovers and you'll have prosperity and you'll have fun and you'll have happiness, and it only costs, is enough. And so people are needy, and especially looking for intimacy. And so much is commodities being put forth to make people think, you have this commodity, you have intimacy, you have happiness. Now, that's mind control. It's very intense. And then there's mind control of intimidation. Most people in their jobs are under mind control. That they have to really toe the line, otherwise they'll lose chance for career, they will not get promoted, or so many different things. In some cases, it's right out exploitation, is that if they don't do what the boss wants, then they get sacked. So they're so, especially, this sexist thing a lot also. It's like in Washington, because it's so much of a place of the legislative and executive branch of the government in America. And so often, when a girl, and there's like, let's see, what is it? There's like 7 women to every man. And so you can imagine, the women are frustrated somewhat. So what happens then, is that so often, women are interviewed for a job. And so here's the position open to be secretary for this councilman, or secretary for this CEO. And so they've really been interviewed to be a secretary. How old are you? And can you work overtime? And on Saturdays and Sundays also? Sometimes? And let's see, you don't have a ring on your finger, do you? And if you do, it doesn't matter so much. And are you happily married? Huh? And so here, also like a mind control, because once one is in a position, and then they're in a delicate situation, and they're thinking, I got to pay my mortgage, my bond, and for my sports car, et cetera, et cetera. And so, oh, what is it? A little sex here and there, and it's no big thing. So people get into a habit of sometimes so much wanting to be accepted, wanting to be appreciated, or wanting to keep whatever they have, or wanting to get whatever they want, so they kind of sell themselves out in this way. And often, in leadership, this is exploited constantly, 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 where individuals, once they get into power, and then they start using that power to see how they can stay in power, how they can control others, influence others, and so they tell this person that, and you watch him, you watch that person. Somebody doesn't seem like they're rising, you're going to take their position, they get the person sacked, or they create a situation where they can just give out little peanuts to people. And they say, well, you give me this, and see what people's concerns are. And they give them something, so that person will be loyal. Give somebody else something, and they'll be loyal. And then they are enjoying while they're giving out little pismos here and there and a few little nice words. But in the back of their mind, they're thinking, how can I control these people? Huh? And then as soon as one of those persons somehow doesn't agree with them, then you see the real individual come out. The same one who was like so kind to you now becomes so harsh. And the same one who seemingly gave you so much protection, now they're trying to demise you. And so this is more than likely what happens in most environments, because this is the kind of culture of deviation. People are not really that selfless. And so when you find those who are really more selfless, then, that is a higher level of spirituality. But we realize that practically everything we do, you have to be careful about the mind-controlled influence. Certain fads, certain things that are being we're being subjected to, got to get us to think a certain way. And so one wants to be more of an independent thinker. It doesn't mean to be selfish or self-centered, but one wants to be independently spiritual-minded. Prabhupada said, Prabhupada never wanted to just have blind followers. Matter of fact, there were times Prabhupada got very angry. Once in New York, and the president there. It was a large temple, one of our biggest temples at that time in the world. And the president had gotten a little crazy. And it was in some kind of illusion that actually one point he was a sannyasi. And then he was going to marry this lady who was supposed to be one of the wealthiest ladies in the world. She was a Japanese lady, supposedly an inheritor, you know, the Toyota family. So he was supposed to make this sacrifice to marry her, you know, for the benefit of the movement. And so, and so later, I mean, you know, he married her, going to find out that she was just a con woman, and she had moved to the temple with him, and they were all just controlling the devotees, and they were even eating abominable things at one point in the temple, and just amazing what was happening. And Prabhupada found out, he was so angry. Like, why people didn't see this, didn't open their eyes? Why did they allow this lunacy to go on? And the one or two devotees who spoke out against the Prabhupada was very happy that they did this. Because so many people suffered under that regime. And they were just kind of constantly kind of considering, well, he must be right, you know, he's the authority. And he was helping some people and doing this, doing that. And they said, well, yeah, it must be okay. But later, of course, it did come out. And then the person, you know, left somewhat in shame. But at the same time, it did lots and lots of pain. So we are to, in spiritual sangha, people should be submissive and kind and tolerant, but we are to be spiritual scientists. And we are to evaluate based on the scripture. And the scripture tells us what constitutes the activities of a sadhu. We don't have to speculate. The scripture tells us what are the qualities of a sadhu. And we see a sadhu is the Prabhu Lakshana, most important aspect of sadhu is full dependence on Krishna. We see that the sadhu is not engaged in duplicity. The sadhu does not make enemies and friends. Even when there's a problem, the sadhu doesn't hold grudges. The sadhu doesn't try to destroy someone. The sadhu doesn't have to go on a campaign. The sadhu is constantly, even when the sadhu is hard, the sadhu is thinking, how can I help this person? And so a real sadhu does exactly what Krishna does. Krishna has these loving pastimes where he is just engaged in the amorous activities with the gopis and with his devotees. And Krishna also has the kshatriya aspect of where he annihilates the demons. But when he annihilates the demons, he liberates them. So the sadhu is supposed to do what? Any high-level sadhu who always does both things, or they're not a high-level sadhu. Sadhu who's only just chastising, only looking at the deviant, only talking about the dangers of the material world, and only just heavy people out, not a real sadhu. But also the sadhu who's only talking about the pastimes, loving pastimes, and not dealing with the nation, is not a high-level sadhu. Because the sadhu is to represent Krishna. So therefore, the more one is Krishna conscious, the more one takes on the mood of Krishna. So we have to not to be blind, because if we're too blind, it actually means we are too selfish about our own situation. And so because we're too much of a coward about our own situation, we may be afraid to look deeper in the scriptures, or afraid to address an issue because we don't want to be on the bad side of that person. We want to be on the good side of everybody by doing what is spiritual, even if somebody's own mind does not appreciate it. Because when you care about somebody, you don't want to see somebody taking poison. Somebody's taking poison, and you say, I wonder how long it's going to be before he dies. Somebody's taking poison, you say, well, I don't want to bother him, because if I tell him to put the poison down, he's going to get angry and think that I don't care about the fact that he's thirsty. So let me just let him deal with his thirst, and later he'll find out for himself. Or, you know, let him take the poison, as long as no poison in my food, I don't know, you know, I'm not going to worry about it. So, no. You think, oh, this person's taking poison, I must do something to try to help them. Even if they keep on taking the poison, at least you have a duty based on your love to try to let this person know, Babu, that's poison. They get angry at you. Oh, what do you mean it's poison? You're just envious because you don't have what I have. What do you mean it's poison? Why don't you take some and try it? So one doesn't get too caught up in the personality thing. Get too caught up in personality, then you would like this person's personality, you want them to like your personality. We want to be deeper than that. We want to be thinking, what do I do and say that will be connected with that person's higher existence? And sometimes it means to say something that may not be eager for the person who wasn't here, but because you care about them. Your little child who wants to just go out and play in the streets or stay out all day long and not do their homework or not come and eat, you don't say, well, I don't want to disturb her, so whenever she comes home, she comes home. You know, what kind of parent is that? But the parent sets up boundaries and does some clarifications. But now, sometimes, someone may just not want to deal with that because they think, well, let somebody else tell them that that's poison. And somebody else says, well, let somebody else tell them that's poison. And the person dies and say, well, I thought you were going to tell them. I thought you were going to tell them. But no, it's the duty of love to try to see what you can do, you know, try to help this person. And that's spiritual. Any other questions? Yoga means to link. So there are different ways of how to link up with truth, with knowledge, or with some particular goal. So just in summary, there's like hatha yoga, which is mainly yoga of dealing mostly with addressing the physical body. Sometimes it's for health, for longevity, for beauty, and these yogas all have potency. And then there is karma yoga that emphasizes more about the principles connected with yoga, reincarnation, reciprocity, how to do certain things to get certain boons, etc., certain achievements. And then there is Ashtanga yoga, which deals with things like Kundalini yoga, Raja yoga, and Integral yoga, where there's more emphasis on like the psychic powers, or the metaphysical, the psychic, engaging in pranayamas and meditations that are more for trying to acquire nirvana or samadhi, mystical, spiritual intoxication, so to speak. And then there is Jnana yoga, which deals more with the yoga of knowledge, of really trying to intellectually understand things in a very, you know, refined way. And then there's bhakti. So, where most of the yogas are still about trying to get something, experience something for oneself, trying to be free of something, of some distraction, some disturbance, trying to know something. But the platform of bhakti, which is the spiritual level that we're talking about, is the liberty, the umbrella. Because although bhakti is about surrender and love and submissiveness, to really do come to that in a healthy way, then there's also knowledge, there's also ritual and practice, there's also understanding about better taking care of the body and the principles that are associated with physical body, subtle body, and with the universe, the principles of karma. So this bhakti is the level of, dear Lord, thy will be done. The bhakti is the level of, how can I serve you? The bhakti is the level that I am so much concerned with love that I have no problem even inconveniencing myself. So that is the platform of spirituality. That it is lacking, what is lacking is such self-motivation. So it's the connection of the highest expressions of love. Now we're talking about love. This is a word that's thrown around so much, it almost means nothing to most people. Because somebody say, oh, well, don't you love me? Then why are you not doing this or doing that? As though if you love me, then you must do this. Some people, they put their own conceptions of love, or they're so much watching Hollywood, Bollywood, watching so many movies and reading so many, you know, romance novels and magazines, that confuses them about what, you know, real love is. So they're thinking love means that we left over each other. Love means that you give me what I want, and when you start giving me what I want, then I go somewhere else, and I find another lover who's going to give me what I want. And so it's very confusing, because many times we have not really had so much experience with, you know, a loving type of environment. And that love really has a lot to do with truthfulness and concern about, you know, about your beloved's well-being. So sometimes that love is manifested in just constant rewarding, facilitating, providing. Sometimes that same love we see, like the parent gives, is in giving some restriction or some chastisement. And sometimes that restriction and chastisement is a higher love than when you give the praise. Just like when a leader sees someone is deviant and they call him out, that's a higher love than even giving praise. So when you praise someone, you're just kind of thanking them for what is going on. When you call someone out and you chastise them, you are going to look close, or you're trying to look close at what needs to be fixed. And you're putting yourself more in a risk situation. Because when you praise someone, almost 99.9% person is going to be happy. Thank you. It's about time I realized it. More praise. But when you call someone out on something, most people have really big trouble accepting feedback. Because most individuals, to the degree that someone is artificial, the harder it is to accept feedback. To the degree that someone is not loving or don't think you love them, the harder it is to accept feedback. When you care about people, even if you are totally convinced that they're wrong, when you have feedback from them, it's important to you because you care about them. And so if it's important to them to bring it up, it's important to you. Even if you think it's wrong, you try to see how to use it, how to process it. But when you don't care about people, or when you are not really in a position of really trying to be servant, then you're eager to accept the praise. You do things almost to demand it. And when there is something different, you go berserk. Yeah? You get empowered like on a target. It becomes a mantra. I get this person. I want to show this person is wrong. Don't you think this person is wrong also? What about you? Are you accepting yet? You build your fort up. And so this is all material. It is very dangerous, because when people have that kind of consciousness, it's like a time bomb. And they have a lot of trouble later in their spiritual life, because it means that these are serious weeds. And so everyone has free will. So when you call somebody out, you have to also be able to back away from the results and leave the results up to Krishna. But if you don't call someone out and you're so-called spiritual, that takes away from your own spirituality. When there's deviation and you tolerate it or you reinforce it, because by tolerating, you reinforce it. And then you're helping to create more of the culture of mixed devotional service. And that's why when Krishna comes, he calls out the deviation, he annihilates the demons, and simultaneously, he enhances the bhakti. But some people these days, they don't want to hear that. Sometimes they will get disturbed by ISKCON or Prabhupada. They only want to hear, you know, the Madhurya Rasa. They only want to hear about wonderful, wonderful pastimes. Yes, so what's going to happen? Our whole existence is given to us by Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, Hari Bhakti Vilas, Nectar Devotion. It's all about what is to be done and what is not to be done. When we take initiation and line ourselves with the Parampara, we get what is to be done, what is not. We get our beads for chanting the Lord's name, but before we have that, we have a formal little lecture on the 10 offenses that, you know, that'll be the one you wanted to avoid. And so an integral part of being a Vaishnava is getting the new name, getting the blessed deeds, repeating the 4 offenses. Even though everybody knows them, still repeat them, remind yourself. And even though we know the 10 offenses, we bring that up because we also want the person to realize
hey, this works if you can avoid this. And if you can't avoid these things, then even what we're giving you is not going to work for you fully. And that's why you can have somebody who's chanting for 20 or 30 years, and they can have so much obnoxious behavior. Not that the process doesn't work, is that they're not working fully, being fully genuine, and therefore it's like having medicine, but you're only taking it in a piecemeal way. You only get certain meager benefits. And so because Krishna cannot be cheated or bribed, then he will give a chance for rectification. But then if we don't change, then he helps us by just bringing us down in different ways, different ways. And so therefore when we see people in high positions fall down, it really means Krishna had already sent signals and warnings, didn't accept it, so therefore he gave him heart love by making it more obvious or by bringing it to greater situations where the person could be helped by then exposing them, you know, or bringing them down. Because there's really not really an accidental fall in that sense, because things have already accumulated, and then then they manifest. And because we see this happen year after year after year, we should realize, hey, we really have to do more in protecting each other. Really have to be more sensitive to what's in the scripture, what constitutes sadhu, be more sensitive toward the offenses, be more careful in our own lives, be more careful to try to protect others. We don't want to have year after year after year this sannyasi, this leader, this temple president, this temple commander. Oh, how's he doing? Well, do you really want to know? I saw him last Ram Nomi, and before that I saw him going to the pub. You wonder, how is it? He knew so much, he spoke so much in the philosophy, but these weeds. These weeds choke. The weed is not taken away, then the plant that is so wonderful, then it chokes the weed. I mean, it chokes the plant. The weed chokes the plant. Any last questions? See, the bhakti is a culture of love. Religion, its highest level, spirituality, unmotivated service, it is really about genuine compassion. And genuine compassion means have the real heart of a sadhu. And the sadhu is really thinking, how can I be the servant of service? How can I somehow glorify Krishna, whatever the opportunity is? How can I somehow express my gratitude for what Krishna has given? And the real sadhu is also seeing Krishna in every person. And that's why we were saying the other day, is how as one becomes more and more advanced, they have strength, but they also have an amazing humility, because they genuinely are feeling and sensing Krishna in every person. And they're not, just theoretically thinking, well, Krishna is on the altar, or he's in the spiritual realm, and everybody else, I don't know, they're just somehow just part of my Maya test. Realize that. It's not like in the spiritual world, everybody's thinking, well, when Krishna comes, everything is going to happen. And they're just bored and fired out with each other. No, it's that there's such love amongst each other, and when Krishna comes, it just adds to all the beauty that's already there. And so we have to create more and more in our environment, in our community, we have to create that mood of the spiritual world to be able to ultimately to have existence in the spiritual world. We are practicing in community now what we can eternally have in community. From the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, the Hadith, and what all these scriptures talk about, that this is not our home, then they're letting us know, oh, we have to reform, we have to change, we have to repent, and then we have a chance to connect with all of the wonderful treasures, that are available for us. If you look at Prabhupada's own life, we see how Papa was like so gentle, was like a kid, sometimes. But he was so heavy and just intense, whenever deviation, he was heavy. Just the other day, someone was bringing this question up in Durban. about once in Prabhupada sent you know some of the sannyasis away, and some of the leaders he just dismissed them, you know, from the society, because he did just like Maharaj Pritchard. Maharaj Pritchard saw some deviation. He quickly was ready to deal with it. But the idea is that when the improper is categorized, then it allows more and more strength, you know, to that that's proper. When the improper isn't, it becomes like a cancer. There's different ways of surfacing, and, you know, like a virus. It just goes on and on. And so the rulers of ancient times, they were very merciful, but they were very poignant, very exacting, you know, when there was deviation. And so there are times when Prabhupada would call out one of his secretaries or something, and he would just make them cry radically. And he would have darshan, oh yes, and our such and such, you know, he can't even null a letter. You know, so much mind is in so much sense gratification that we give him a letter and he couldn't even post a letter in the right way. One would wonder, my Prabhupada's so worried about a little letter or a little this or that, but he was seeing that this is connected with other deviations, other tendencies in the consciousness, or he was so much eager and wanting that disciple to be a pukka that he wanted to call out. So he was really giving special mercy. He was calling out that disciple. Even more than, you know, when he was giving praise. Because he was going deeper into that disciple's issue to call him out on that, you know. When the parent is really trying to correct the child some bad tendency, bad habit that they have, the parent is really very concerned about the future and the well-being of their child. So that's even more of an energy and involvement to connect and to help than when the parent goes and buys the kid, you know, a bicycle because he got, you know, nice scores on his test. Because in one case, good act is there, and there's recognition of that. In another case, the bad act is there, and it's more, you know, disclosed. And so there's need to help the person in that way. But like sometimes, you know, you're sleepy, and it's time to come down to the program or something, somebody wakes you up, and you get angry. Leave me alone. So it's time for Mangalarti. So it's time for you to, do your service, to, start the work in the kitchen. The person gets angry. Don't bother me. Let me go back to sleep. So when someone is sleeping, and you got to wake them up, they get angry. And that's why some people don't like to do that, you know, bother because they want to deal with their anger. But if they need to be walking, you know, somebody has to wake them up. Any last questions? Or comments? It's not easy. I'm going to end with this. Just think about the example, you know, of the Acharya. Or think about, you know, like any major prophet. Were they popular? We look from, let's give an example. Let's see, Zoroaster. He was quite astute in, you know, preaching, you know, in personalism, about, you know, liberation, rising outside of material body, material energy. He was stabbed, you know, to death. And let's see, Socrates. So Socrates, he was very philosophical. He would challenge people, get them into dialogue and discussion, to think. He was arrested. He was in prison. And, you know, he was made to, you know, take poison. The deviants felt he was polluting the mind, especially of the youth. But he was really just, you know, stimulating people, you know, by his discourse. We've seen the case, you know, of Buddha, that he was chased from village to village. His life was threatened. The case of Muhammad, assassination attempt. He was poisoned. He didn't die from it, but he was very sick until the time of his death. Was he from that? In the case of Jesus, he was crucified. In the case of Bhaktisiddhanta, you see the Prabhupada, you know, there were assassination attempts, you know, that were being arranged on Bhaktisiddhanta. Bhakti Vinod, we see also, his life, his family was being threatened. Prabhupada, there were several times, and there were attempts on his life. And so, even Krishna's Nitya Siddhas, when they come into this world, they are disturbance to those who want status quo, or those who want to control the mass of the people's minds and to get them to buy into situations. And so we see that their nature is that they're actually revolutionists. Spiritualists are revolutionists because they are going into the flow. They're going to get this matter. They're sort of anti-material. They're on a mission. Because of that, they stir things up. So there's always kind of a love-hate relationship. Some people love them very much, and others just want, you know, just want to destroy them. It's in the case of, you know, in the case of Ramanujacharya, stories in the relationship to Madhavacharya, Bhakacharya, where they're, you know, they were a disturbance. And the biggest disturbance they were is to the pseudo religious. You know, who killed Jesus? And we see, you know, the Pharisees and the priests, they were the ones who were most disturbed. Because he was reigning on their parade. Huh? In the case of Ramanuja and others, is that they were unauthentic. And so the presence of these personalities was too much a disturbance, you know, to the cheating. So therefore they tried to turn it around as if they were, you know, the villain, and even arranged, you know, for their assassination. So this happened. This is why Krishna is so kind. Krishna is so kind that even though this happens every time when Krishna sends different types of representatives, but he still sends them, and he sends them. And this is why the story of Jesus is like, you know, so powerful. Because here, he's so young, you know, when he was crucified, and he gave his life in trying to help people, and the people he was trying to help, you know, they turned against him. But if Jesus would have been on the cross, and while they crucified him, he said, "And, by the way, I hate all you guys." "And you're going to see, boy, you got to pay for this stuff." I mean, my Father, he's powerful. And he knows all of you are marked. You're going to suffer, your family, your village, for generations and generations, you're going to suffer. If he would have said like that, they have been a whole other story. Yeah? If Haridasa Koi, if he would have said, you know, while they were, you know, calling him out and beating him, and he would have jumped up with his mystic power and killed them all, or if he would have said, "Hey Krishna, bring the Sudarshan Chakra, these guys." "You said hit me twice. Come on." You know, it'd been a whole different story. But because they did what they had to do, and they took the consequences of the situation, you know, you're then glorious in that sense. Because see, the more someone is spiritual, the more there's Maya, it actually glorifies them. Because the Maya shows in contrast to the spiritual potency. Or the more they're spiritual, the more their existence brings out the Maya, really to help them get rid of it. But it's just natural. Is that where there is some light, then, you know, it affects the nation. It affects the darkness. Turn the light on, have a fresh light. So it agitates in that way. And that's why it's understood that when you really take to a spiritual lifestyle, you're declaring war on Maya. And so it's the Maya that comes from one's own senses and mind, and the Maya which from the environment. So we're all really on the battle of Kurukshetra. And each of us are really having our own kind of battlefield that's there. And in the high level devotees of the Lord, they're like generals. And so Maya always wants us somehow to try to stop the general. So when these really high level souls come, the great acharyas, then they're always assassination attempts, blasphemous attempts, attack, misinformation, because somehow Kali wants to stop them in such a way. And even many times, you know, their lives are taken in such a way. But then Krishna keeps sinning. And even if that Krishna comes himself, and we see how people, you know, still don't accept. So when we look at all the opulences of Krishna, sometimes it's considered one of his greatest opulences is his mercy on the conditioned souls. That in spite of the fact that souls have run away, and he's going himself to reclaim them, he sends his ambassadors, and the ambassadors, people they're trying to help, are the ones who turn against him often the most. So it was those who were closest or who were part of the spiritual circles who were disturbed with Buddha, Bahula, Prabhupada also many, many attempts on his own life, on the life of his followers. So that is happening and will happen within the material realm. Because the material world is a place of duality and confusion and abuse and exploitation. So we're trying to become not like this. We're trying to become genuinely selfish. And so the demons really want to control, the pseudo-religions want to control, politicians want to control, and the sadhus, they want to be controlled by Krishna. They want to be used by Krishna, and they want to empower others and not to disempower. And so the spirituals are trying to help us all see what we can become and not to just be at the mercy of just, you know, control enemies and friends to give out some benefits. And if we are, we'll walk the path of them, if not, you know, then it's different. But we want feedback. And we want a chance to understand, how can I serve better? How can I facilitate better? How can I be a better devotee? When Lord Chaitanya, you know, was accused, you know, by Ramachandra, Ramachandra Puri, he didn't get angry. He just, you know, went on doing what he had to do. And Ramachandra Puri didn't change. But there was consequence. And so there's consequence as we engage in devotion, and the more knowledge we get, the more facility we get, the more we have a duty to change and to come up to that facility. So this is spiritual. Material is when we're trying to get something for ourselves, and we're being disrespectful towards the spiritual rule and law, being disrespectful towards God. Religion is how to know and serve the Lord based on his desires and his dictates. And when we try to get around that, then there's a problem. Because the Lord is in the heart. He's watching. So if everyone is genuinely wanting to surrender, Godhead will arrange such. But if we want just mystic power, we want just to somehow have the kingdom of God without God, we want to just have mystical intoxication, we'll get that also. But we want to be ultimately happy because it's just addressing the physical body or it's the subtle body. But we're really happy when things are directed towards the soul. ISKCON found the child, his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Sri Bhuvati. Hare Krishna.